If you find the tension space at the point P, algebraically, the key idea here was that a tangent vector should be corresponding to a director in space. And we know of directional derivatives. So directional derivatives also corresponds to a direction in space, the direction you want to differentiate in. And then we said, well, we know how to recognize derivatives, how to define derivatives. In fact, we know how to define derivatives in a fairly abstract way, where we don't even have to worry about Newton, Leibniz, limit taking, and so on, algebraically. So the idea was to identify tangent vectors with directional derivatives. And the idea for defining directional derivatives was to define them as derivations on the algebra of germs of functions at the point. What it says is on.
It's on.
So we define the tangent space GP of N, the tangent space of the manifold N at the point P, as the set of so-called derivations of an algebra, the algebra of function germs. Namely, what does it mean that a tangent vector is a derivation? It means a tangent vector is any linear map, psi, that maps function germs into real numbers in such a way that it maps the product of two function germs. And you can always think of a function germ as being represented by one function. Just pick a representative out of the Jones class, that's what function germ is. So, a derivation, a tangent vector is a derivation, and a derivation is a linear map of function germs at the point P into R, such that if I calculate the tangent vector, or equivalently the directional derivative at the point, if I calculate the tangent vector's action on the product of two functions, then I obtain the same as if I took the tangent vector's action on the first function times the second function evaluated at the point where we differentiate, plus the first function evaluated at the point where we differentiate, times the action of the tangent vector on the second function. This is the usual Leibniz rule that we know holds for ordinary derivatives. And it turns out that the Leibniz rule is, in fact, equivalent to the Newton-Leibniz limit and this all of this business, algebraically. Well, essentially, we would be overcounting a lot. See, for this purpose, the action of the tangent vector on a function is exactly the same for all functions.
So they're equivalent.
But they're in the function term, right? And so it's just to, well, it's for mathematical efficiency in a way, right? Because otherwise you would say that well, you could do without them. You could just work with functions, individual functions, and then just say, well, it doesn't actually depend so much on the function as on the current stuff that it belongs to. And we will get rid of that the moment that we work on functions on the entire manifold, when you are no longer restricted to just the point. Okay, so please remember this thing here, that it's all the action of the tangent vector, that is to say the action of the directional derivative on the product of the function, this tangent vector on the first function times the second function evaluated at the point where we
want to differentiate, just like that. OK. So this definition is useful because it is quite abstract, doesn't rely on taking any limits, and can be generalized, for example, for non-commutative geometry. But more importantly, perhaps for our course, is that this whole concept of defining derivatives as derivations of an algebra is very powerful and can be used to introduce all derivatives that there are in differential geometry. That would be the Lie derivative, covariant derivatives of various kinds, exterior derivatives, co-derivatives, all of those are derivations. And you just have to say what type of derivation and the rest follow. So you don't have to worry about the intricate details of those derivations, such as the Lie derivative. They're all entirely defined once you say what kind of derivation they are on the algebra. And then all the individual details follow. Yes?
The derivative question, why does it have to be an equivalence class? Isn't it that we define the action of the operator on the equivalence class because we want functions with the same derivative to have the same, to correspond to the same tangent vector?
Yes, they do. That's right.
Okay.
And the point is that when we form the derivative, then we have this nice algebra structure for those terms. As I said, the Lagrangian itself is already enforcing the structure of the derivative. Let's see how that works. For example, in the simplest case, let's look at a constant function. The function that maps all of the points, maps p onto the number c. C is just a constant real number. And it maps also any other point onto the same real number. Its germ is, of course, the set of all those functions which are constant with this value in some neighborhood of p. So the function is c of p is c, a constant. Then we can easily show that the directional derivative, that is the action of the tangent of a tangent vector psi, on such a constant function is zero for all tangent vectors. As it should be for proper directional derivative, if the function is constant, then all directional derivatives should vanish. So all we know so far is that the psi are a derivation of the algebra. The only thing we know so far is that they obey the linear and obey the Lagrange form. From that we can derive already that the derivative is going to be zero. It's easy. A tangent vector, that is any such derivation that obeys the Leibniz rule, applied to the constant function c, is c times psi applied to the constant function 1, just by linearity. That's one of the things we know about the tangent vectors, that they are linear maps. And so it's c times the tangent vector, tangent vector's action on the functions 1 times the function 1. But now we have the product of two functions, both constant, and we can use the Lagrange rule. We know that the tangent vector is a derivation, so it is c times the action of the tangent vector on the constant function times the constant function, evaluated at the point in question class, vice versa. And so we end up having shown that 2c, the action of psi on 1, is c times the action of psi on 1. And therefore, the action of psi on c is zero. Now, another example.
Let's look at the special case where the manifold in question is Rn. If our definition of our algebraic definition of the tangent space is any good, then we should recover what we know from Rn. We know what directional derivatives look like. Directional derivatives look like this. The directional derivative at the point p is some linear combination of the partial derivative. And the numbers psi I indicate the direction in which this thing is pointing. So we know that in Rn, directional derivatives take this form. what we need to show now is that tangent vectors, or directional derivatives, defined as linear maps into the real numbers that obey the Leibniz rule, are always of this form. So now we want to derive much more than just that the directional derivative of a constant function is zero. Now we want to show that the directional derivative of any function always takes this form, where we define directional derivative as any linear map that obeys the Leibniz rule. So let's see whether that's right. Remember, all we know about psi so far is that it's a linear map that maps constant functions into zero, and that obey the Leibniz rule. So we assume now that psi is one of those. It's a linear map that obeys the Leibniz rule, and f is some function represented by some function. Then, let's introduce a notation that we will use throughout the course when we calculate the partial derivatives of a function with respect to the I variable. We will also indicate this as a comma I. So, for example, if we differentiate with respect to the first variable, we may as well just write h and comma 1. So then, so just do a little calculation. Remember what we want to show. We want to show that any such tangent vector has this form for our own. So, what do we have? The action of a tangent vector on some function at the point P, and we may choose, for example, that this point P in the coordinate system that we use is at 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. Just for funding. Mm-hmm. So the action of our tangent vector on this function can also be written as the action of the tangent vector on this function. This is the original thing again. And here we just added a constant function and subtracted a constant function. What value does this constant function have? Well, it has the value that f takes at 0. Of course, it's the function term of the constant function. Now the trick is that we can write this as an integral, where this is one integration limit and that's the other one. Okay, so this is just taken from the previous equation, and that is exactly those two terms again. Notice that we differentiate with respect to t, this variable t here, which is just some dummy variable that we introduced, and then we integrate over t again. So obviously what we get is that we can integrate this thing out trivially, and we obtain f bar at t equals 1 minus f bar at t equals 0. And that's just those two things here. Just a little trick. Now this, by linearity, we know that the tangent vector applied to this sum of two function terms is, actually there should be bar over the whole thing. The psi applied to the sum of those two function terms is psi applied to the first one plus psi applied to the second one, because the whole thing is linear. This, however, is a directional derivative, is a tangent vector applied to a constant function, and therefore that is zero. And plus the action of the tangent vector on this expression here, where I wrote out what this derivative is, using the chain rule. D by dt is, of course, the same as differentiating with respect to t x I, partially differentiating with respect to each of those t x I, and then differentiating the t x I by dt. Same thing, right? You can basically cross up this and that. Same thing. And from here to there, two things happen. I use the notation that we introduced, in the differentiation with respect to the I variable. It's simply written as comma I. So that's what happened here. This derivative is just replaced by this new notation. Still the derivative, but now we write it as a comma. And these txi by dt is simply xi, of course. Which is what? This is the coordinate function. This is the function that maps x into xi. It's the germ of that function. Now, by linearity, we can pull this sum in front of the integral and also in front of the action of the tangent vector. That's all that's happening between here and there. And now we use that psi, the tangent vector, is by definition something, it's a linear map that obeys the Leibniz rule. And here we have the product of two functions. You see, the tangent vector is acting on this function times that function. So this would always be bar over here. It's always this function term. So we know that, sorry, here it is. So psi is acting on this function times that function. So we use the Leibniz rule to obtain that this is equal to the tangent vector applied to the first function times the second function, evaluated at the point where we differentiate. But the point where we differentiate, we chose to be the origin of the coordinate system so that this is actually zero. So that first term goes away. Plus, the first term evaluated at the point where we differentiate times the tangent vector applied to the second function. So this term, as I said, goes away, and we're left with only this, where we have to evaluate this term at x equals zero, because that's the point where we differentiate. So that these arguments all become just zero. But that means that we have simply a constant in here. This is just numbers. So we are integrating numbers, constants, from zero to one, which is just the number. Now, from here to there, I spelled out what this comma is again. We will freely move between the two notations. So this comma is, of course, partial differentiation with respect to the I variable. So what we obtain is that the action of the tangent vector, psi, on the function f at the point t is given by this expression t. So what it is the sum over some number, right? Remember that the tangent vector is a linear map into the number to the base Leibniz rule. So these are numbers, real numbers, times those partial derivatives of x. This is exactly what we have to show. We have to show that a tangent vector defined as any linear map from function germs into real numbers that obeys the Leibniz rule is of this form, is a directional derivative. You see, this is the partial derivative with some prefactor here. So overall, the equation looks like this, if you remember. The action of a tangent vector on a function f is this. So this is the action of the tangent vector on the function f at the point t. You take the partial derivatives with those coefficients in front. This now is very useful to know.
Do we replace that integral by the derivative fixing? Oh, no, that's not what happened to explain. But perhaps here is not from here to the last. From here to there?
Yeah.
Okay. What happened was that the integral went away completely because this is just a derivative evaluated at
a point, that's just a number. Okay? It's just a number. And if you integrate a number from 0 to 1, you get that number. Okay? And then this comma here is what was written as the partial derivative. Remember that?
That's just another notation for the partial derivative in this comma. Okay? This is what happened.
Yes. And how about the choice? coordinate system. We chose the coordinate system such as the point P would be 0.
That's right. I invite you to do it for other points. It's just much more messy, but the result is good even when it's not chosen at the origin, but it's just getting more messy. You have to do a little bit more tricky integration. See, we integrate here from 0 to 1, and from the point
at the origin to the point A. And if you want to work not with the point at the origin, you just have to start out indicating at the other point. You can do it, but it's so messy. Okay, so what we showed is that every tangent vector defined as a derivation on the algebra of function gen is of this form. It is really partial derivative of the old-fashioned kind, at least for Rn. Now, what are those coefficients here? Well, we can look it up what those coefficients are. Remember, every partial derivative, every directional derivative looks like that. Every directional derivative is partial derivative with some coefficients in front. In our case, what are those I? Well, you can read it off from here. These are the psi I. Right? And what are they? They are the outcome of applying the tangent vector to the coordinate function, which is neat, because it means that as soon as we specify how a tangent vector, if we choose how a tangent vector is acting on coordinate function, then we've chosen how the tangent vector acts on any function. Okay? Because if we know how a tangent vector, or that's our choice really, I mean, we choose a tangent vector by choosing its action on coordinate function. So we choose those coefficients here. We choose how the tangent vector is acting on a coordinate function. For example, you might choose, you know, if the coordinate functions run from I to 1 to 3 in three-dimensional space or so, then I might choose them to be some specific number. They would be those coefficients. I plug them in here. And then I can calculate from that what the action of psi is going to be on any arbitrary function. Okay? I specify a tangent vector by specifying those numbers. How the derivation is acting on coordinate function. So if you were used to thinking of a tangent vector as being some n tuple of numbers, what you were really saying is that those numbers are the action of the tangent vector considered as a derivation on the algebra, on the action of them, of this tangent vector on the coordinate function. This is what the coefficients really are. And if you think of a tangent vector as a vector of coefficients, they are simply the action of the derivation on the coordinate function, and then the action of the derivation of all functions is given in this way. But this is only Rn, and we could have done that with less machinery, right? So this is just to say what I just said. Psi is some derivation. The tangent vector is any arbitrary derivation on this algebra, linear and obeying the Leibniz rule. Just repeating here, because I had it on the slide, knowing how psi acts on the coordinate functions xi gives us the psi I, and we can use this to specify a tangent vector, the truth one, and therefore that means that we know how psi acts on all functions, namely through the equation above. Through this one. All right. So far, so good. Now, this was the simple example where the manifold is Rn. How, however, does our definition of the tangent space work when the manifold is not Rn? If it's really some sort of flying carpet or so, then what? You see those vibrations? Is that an earthquake or? I don't know. There have been two earthquakes. I have been thinking this stuff. Okay. Okay, so just remember, just remember how charts work. Here's the manifold, here's a point on the manifold, and the chart maps points into Rn. In this way, every point of the manifold at least those in the domain of our chart, are given names. And so each point has a name, namely the name is an entity. In this way, we were able to specify points on the abstract manifold simply as to their names over here. Something similar should be possible for tangent vectors. We know now from what we just did how to specify tangent vectors in Rn, but how do we specify tangent vectors on the abstract manifold? Let's use charts for that. Now, what we do now will, you may find a little bit abstract, but this is as abstract as it gets. Don't worry. From there, it's going to be easier from there onwards, once we've done that. So the strategy now, in order to get a handle on tangent vectors on the manifold, the abstract manifold, strategy is to use charts in a clever way. So let us consider two differentiable manifolds. One, M is a differentiable manifold, and N is a differentiable manifold. Do you remember what it means that the manifold is differentiable? How do you define that? Any guesses?
Charts
are
differentiable.
Exactly. You have to have chart changes that are differentiable.
Right? So you have to have a differential manifold is differentiable if you have one chart and another chart covering at least in part the same path. And then if you go from one chart to the manifold and then back the other chart, you end up with a map from Rn into Rn. And for that, we know what differentiability is. Okay? And we say that the manifold is differentiable if for every patch you find at least two charts that cover that patch, and if you go from Rn backwards with a chart into that patch and then back into Rn, you end up with an Rn to Rn map, and that has to be differentiable. Anyway. Later on, we will be mostly interested in the case, not always, but mostly interested in the case where the second manifold is Rn, in which case this would also be called a chart. But generally, there's no harm in just considering the general case, one differential manifold, another differential manifold, and then some diffeomorphism from one to the other, some differentiable map. Again, how do we define that it's differentiable? Well, put a chart here, put a chart there, and then any map from here to there becomes a map from the Rn of this chart to the Rn of that chart. That has to be differentiable. Okay. So assume we have a diffeomorphism here from that manifold into that manifold. In principle, we should specify just a patch. It may not be possible to have a chart covering the entire manifold, but let's not worry about that. That's subtlety. Okay. Now, if we have a diffeomorphism from that first manifold to the second manifold, which we may call little phi, then it actually induces an algebra homomorphism from the algebra of function germ at this point to the algebra of function germ over there. See how that works? It's a map from here to there, from the manifold to the other manifold, and you have, for this manifold, you have at the point P an algebra of function germ. And I'm not drawing that algebra here because that would look like a subset. So I'm drawing it over here. So this circle should symbolizes the algebra of function germ at P. Okay? An element in this algebra are functions or function germ, which an example of that might be F. So a point in this set is a function germ. A point over here is a point in the manifold. Similarly here, this is a point in the manifold Q. Q is a point in the manifold N. And this symbolizes the algebra, the associative algebra of function germ at Q. And we call this function algebra F of Q. A dot, a point, an element of this set is a function germ, for example, U. So what the claim here is now is that whenever you have a diffeomorphism that maps point here into point over there, maps some neighborhood or even all of the manifold into all of the manifold over there, then this induces a map from this function germ algebra into that function germ algebra. Now, how does that work? Imagine you have a function germ T. What is it doing? It maps points of the manifold into the real number. Given such a diffeomorphism, you can construct from this function a function on that manifold, which therefore lives in this algebra. And how do you do that? Well, you take your function G here. Normally, you feed it as input a point of this manifold. And then it spits out a number, a real number. That's what a function does. It feeds it a point, it spits out a number. But since you have this diffeomorphism, you can actually feed it points from over here. Because you can take the point here, map it using a diffeomorphism into the manifold there, and then feed it to G in the usual way. So therefore, a function G in here induces, or let's put this way, the phi here induces for every function G here, a function over this manifold here, and therefore a function in here. Okay? Because those guys are those functions that you can feed points from that manifold. Alright? So any function germ here is being mapped into a function germ over there, simply by saying that I'm feeding the new function and a point over here, which then gets mapped into there, and then I apply this function to it and get a real number out of it. And this algebra homomorphism is called phi star. So phi star is mapping the function germ G, function germ G into a function germ F over here, and we say it is phi star of G in the following way. F, this function, applied to a point of this manifold X, is given by taking this point here, mapping it into this manifold, and then applying V to it. So it's F mapped through phi as an element of manifold M, and then you apply G to it and get a real number. Right? You may have seen similar construction when you first encountered dual vectors in linear algebra. It's just that this business is not necessarily linear. We also write it in the following way. If the image of G under the phi star map is the concatenation of applying first the map phi and then applying the map G, viewing the function G as a map. We will later use this again, and so I give it a name and call it red plus. So now it's getting more complicated. Another round here. If you have a map that maps your functions or function germs this way, then remember what tangent vectors do. Tangent vectors are maps that feed on functions and then give you a number, all right? So the claim now is the following. If you have a map from function germ into function germ, as we just discussed, then this induces a map, PT5, the tangent map, which is mapping tangent vectors to this algebra, to this point, is mapping tangent vectors into tangent vectors, but again, the other way around. See, let's see what we have here. We have a tangent vector psi in this tangent vector space. It's a tangent vector space at this point. What is it doing? You feed it a point in this algebra, you feed it a function, and it gives you a real number. Similarly here, the elements of this tangent space, you feed a function from this algebra, and you get a real number. So now the way it works is this. You take a function here, you take a tangent vector here, and you obtain through this map a tangent vector there the following way. Take the tangent vector, and see this function from here. You take the function from here, map it using phi star into here, but then you can't see it. So effectively, you have obtained a tangent vector over here, because it's feeding on functions over there. That's why every tangent vector here maps into a tangent vector over there. So the notation is that phi star is mapping from f of q into f of p, and tp phi, the tangent map, is mapping from the tangent space of the manifold at the point p, this one, into the tangent space of the other manifold at the point q. And this tangent map, remember that this whole thing is a complicated notation for simply this map here. So this tangent map is mapping tangent vectors into tangent vectors. So overall, remember that the diffeomorphism goes this way, the linear map that maps the tangent vectors into another also goes this way. So so we can also write that eta, the image of that tangent vector, is given by phi star psi. Right? So we take phi star. And then you take psi. Which is to say that eta, the tangent vector on the right hand side, applied to a function on the right hand side, is given by taking the function on the right hand side, taking phi star to move it to the left hand side, and then applying psi. And since phi star of g can also be written as phi, aside, and then after that, aside g. Remember, we had this just a little while ago. Phi star of g is phi, and then aside g. See, this little circuit here means concatenation. It means the first this mass, and then the output of that feed into g. So this equation we use over there. To go from here to there, we write phi star of g as g after phi. Now, the special case that we are particularly interested in is the one where the second manifold, the one on the right, is Rn, because then our diffeomorphism phi is a char. Because we have to assume here that phi is invertible and so on. Phi star is an algebra isomorphism. It maps the algebra of functions on the right into the algebra of functions in the left, on the left, or function term. And tp phi is a vector space isomorphism. By the way, are you all familiar with what it means to have an algebra isomorphism or vector space isomorphism?
What it means is that
The axiomatic structures are preserved in the sense that whether you first use the axiom and then apply the map, or the other way around, is the same thing. So, for example, what is a vector space isomorphism? Well, a vector space, you know, you can add two vectors. And if you map from one vector space into the other, and it is a vector space isomorphism, then in particular, what you can do is this. You can first take two vectors, add them, and then map the result, or you can first map the two vectors and then add them. That's a simple example, but you can do it for all structures. You can do it for the algebra structure, where you first multiply two functions and then map, or you first map the two functions and then multiply them to do the same, if you have an algebra isomorphism, and so on. Homeomorphism, diffeomorphism means, you know, you can do the operations of differentiation and the mapping, and it's interesting. Okay, so why did we do this? Well, we did it because ultimately we are interested in getting a handle on a tangent space of a point of the abstract manifold. So here's the point. We have a chart, diffeomorphism. Remember that this means that we have induced a phi star, which is mapping our function germs into function germs, and a tangent map, which maps tangent vectors here into tangent vectors there. You see, this is very useful. Remember that here we have points that were given names over here, which are those entropies. And here now we have that this is the space of tangent vectors on the manifold over here. So they are just linear maps that map function terms into real numbers obeying the Leibniz rule. And they are being mapped into tangent vectors in Rn, which is ever so convenient because we know how to specify those ones. Okay, so again, every tangent vector here has an image over there.
To prove that the result is still tangent tangent vector, like when we map T to TRN, TRN is still a tangent
vector. Yes, in principle, you would have. That's right. You would have to check that really this goes through with the Leibniz rule.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I invite you to do that.
You're right.
Yes, it's not trivial. I mean, it's very easy to go through linearly, but you have to spell it out. I invite you to do it.
Okay, so what we have is that, on the one hand, given the chart phi, every abstract point of the manifold has a concrete image phi of phi as a name in Rn from n Cooper, but also every abstract vector psi in the tangent vector space of the abstract manifold at some abstract point p has now a concrete image in the tangent vector space of the image of p. Which is just repeating what I already said. And the image of our tangent vector in Rn is concrete because we know that tangent vectors can obviously be written as linear combinations of of partial derivatives in Rn. We know that every tangent vector in Rn must take that form. That's what we proved with this lengthy calculation of there. So therefore, you can specify an arbitrary tangent vector, abstract tangent vector on the manifold by choosing a chart and then specifying for a given point, you know what its name is, and then at this point, look at the tangent vector state, specify a tangent vector, and you know that its free image under the tangent map is some tangent vector in the abstract manifold. So all you have to specify some concrete numbers there and the chart. So, very conveniently, we can do the following. Assuming a fixed chart, we can choose a point in Rn, and it will denote some point of the manifold, and we can choose an n-tuple of coefficient which corresponds to some directional derivative in Rn, but through the chart and its tangent map, it is also a name for an abstract tangent vector at the point P. So, for example, the tangent vector in Rn, eta, which is simply the partial derivative in one particular direction, is the image of some abstract tangent vector on the abstract manifold for some fixed phi. Phi is the chart. We assume this to be fixed. So if you fix the chart, then as long as you stay within the same chart, you can always choose a basis of your tangent space on the abstract manifold by choosing a basis of your tangent space in Rn. Because all those partial derivatives here will correspond to partial derivatives, will correspond to tangent vectors on the abstract manifold. This, however, is a symbolic notation. We should really not, it's sometimes used, I try to avoid this, but it's sometimes used. The proper notation would be to say that psi is the inverse tangent map applied to this. If this is a partial derivative at the image of the point P in Rn, and if we apply the inverse of the tangent map, we get back on the left-hand side to the abstract manifold, that's what it's like. But you can imagine that in practice, you don't necessarily have the patience to always do this if you always work in the same task, and therefore you might identify those things with a node. All right, so we are at the end of the third set of lecture notes. There might be an opportunity for you to ask questions if you like. How's the connection to Waterloo and Souk Wells? Is it still okay? Oh. Yeah, so far there haven't been any questions. Let's see. Yeah, so this is a question to the cameraman. Can you do something about the microphone? Apparently in Guelph, they can't hear me very well. Is it a matter of the volume, or is it cutting out? I see. Well, the thing is that, in principle, the cameraman is switching between my microphone and the room microphone. So whenever there's a question from the task, it will be picked up by the room microphone, so it hangs from the ceiling there, and then it should be switching back, or he should be switching back to my microphone here. So normally you shouldn't hear the task, except if somebody in the task asks a question. Last time, apparently, we had the problem that the room microphone was left on too long, because then you can hear me all right, but with a lot of echo. So that's why the room microphone should normally be switched off when the cast is not talking. Okay, so remember, this is our picture. We have all those maps. This is the chart. This is the algebra homomorphism that maps functions into functions this way, and then we get the linear tangent map that gets us the map tangent vectors and tangent vectors. So if you specify a tangent vector here, it specifies implicitly a tangent vector here on the upper tangent floor. Okay. Yes?
Are they actually really trivial, or do you have to prove them for the algebra isomorphisms of I star and vector isomorphism, vector space isomorphism?
I mean, you have to, okay, in principle, when you're claiming that this is an algebra homomorphism, it means that it doesn't matter whether you first multiply and then map,
right,
first map and then multiply. You need to absolutely prove it.
Yeah, no, with the isomorphism part of it, because then we also need the bijection into it, so.
Yes.
Okay.
Go ahead. Yes. Yeah, we could go into those details, but really we have a lot to cover, and
okay,
I don't want to go into too many details. I found it important to go through the proof that we did go through today, but those things I'm not sure whether they would be very instructive. After all, we want to arrive at GR eventually, so. Okay. All right.
Okay. Now, what if we change class? What if we change coordinate system? That will lead us to a connection between the algebraic definition of what is a tangent vector and the physicist's definition of what is a tangent vector. Physicists like to define tangent vectors through their transformation properties, meaning through how they behave under change of coordinate system. In our language, how they behave under change of class. So let's see what happens when we change class. Here we have a manifold M with a point P, and let's say that there are two charts. There's one diffeomorphism that maps it into Rn called theta, and another one, alpha, that maps it also into Rn. So we have three manifolds in the game now. Two of them are Rn. So every point here has now two names, or two coordinates. With respect to the first chart, it has some coordinates, x tilde, and with respect to the other chart, it has some other coordinates that we may call x. X1 to xn, and here, x tilde 1 to x tilde n. This is what is going on when we have two coordinate systems for the same manifold. Every point in the manifold has two names, has two n tuples that specify it. Now, the interesting thing is that if in this scenario, since this is a diffeomorphism, and invertible. And that is a diffeomorphism that's invertible. They have charts, after all, coordinate systems. We can concatenate them. We can, for example, start here and then do the inverse of alpha. So we map points here into the abstract manifold and then use the other chart theta to map them into there, which gets us from Rn into Rn. So we are on safe territory as far as analytic functions are concerned. So what we obtain is a map capital phi that is alpha inverse and after that theta, which is mapping Rn into Rn. It is a change of coordinates, which is what we looked at before. So as we change coordinates system from alpha to beta, and the coordinates of the point P change from x1 to xn, the left hand side to x tilde 1 to x tilde n on the right hand side. And we can say that the coordinates on the right hand side are obtained from the coordinates on the left hand side by applying this map phi, which goes this way, remember? So we can write that the x tildes are phi I of x1 to xn, phi being the concatenation of alpha inverse and theta. Now a function, or function germ f on the abstract manifold has now two images. It has an image in the first coordinate system, and it has an image in the second coordinate system. And of course, the value that these functions take at the point in question is always the same. Right? So the function f takes a particular value, let's say pi, at the point p. Now, of course, the image of the function in the first coordinate system also takes the value phi at the image of the point P. And, of course, the image of the function F in the other coordinate system evaluated at the image of the point P is also phi. This is what it means, that the function has different representations. That it has image in coordinate system. So the value of the function, function f is function g in one coordinate system and it is function h in another coordinate system, but the output of the function is always the same no matter whether you evaluate it on the manifold or in any one of the coordinate systems. So g at those points is the same as h at those points. Same thing. We will refer to this later on again, so I give it a name, red star. Not getting more complicated than that. So the so a tangent vector psi now also has two images, right? I mean a point has two images, here's one, there's one. The function germs have images over here and over there. And similarly the tangent vectors, a tangent vector on the abstract manifold has an image over here as a tangent vector on Rn, but also has an image over there as a tangent vector over Rn here. And these are the usual maps. Remember that if this one goes from here to there, also the tangent map of it goes from there to there. So by construction, we have that since they're all just images of another, the left and the right thing, images of what's going on in the abstract manifold, we have that the abstract tangent vector, an abstract tangent vector on the abstract manifold applied to a function f on the manifold gives you the same real number as if you took the image of psi in under one chart, which we call eta, and applied to the image of f under the chart, and it gives you the same as if you did it for the other chart. So eta and mu are just images of psi, and g and h are images of f. And this means in particular, and this is how we eventually arrive at the transformation rule, means in particular that if you have a directional derivative in one of the two charts, so for one Rn, this is a directional derivative, theta I, partial derivatives acting on g, then, but evaluated at the point q, which is the image of the point P on the manifold, then this must give you the same number as if you evaluated the directional derivative or the tangent vector, the image of the abstract tangent vector in the other chart. Okay, this is the other chart partial derivative, and applied to the image of the function in question. Remember this star? It showed that h of x tilde is g of x. So we put this g of x in here. But now that is differentiating with respect to the x tilde, but g depends on the x. So we use the chain rule to rewrite those derivatives in terms of x tilde as derivatives in terms of x. You obtain this. You see, you could just cancel out those things and be left with the derivative with respect to x tilde. So we obtain this equation overall, which is telling us that since this has to be true for all functions g, this is telling us how the coefficient, the number-valued coefficient of our tangent vector, our abstract tangent vector in one coordinate system, is related to the number-valued coefficient mu of the same abstract tangent vector on the manifold in another coordinate system. So we have now the relationship between the eta's and the mu. You see, the g is the same here, and the partial derivatives are the same. It must be true for all g, for all functions. And therefore, this stuff has to be the same as that. Okay, so what we can conclude from this is that the coefficient of the same abstract tangent vector on the manifold in one chart, theta I, and this is the actual full tangent vector in the in one chart, is given also in this form, and we can therefore read of that the eta I and the mu j are related through this Jacobian matrix. This, you know, this is the derivative of the x I with respect to the x tilde. Remember what that is really. It is the map capital Phi is the map alpha inverse theta. Okay. So it's a concatenation of the two diffeomorphisms. And that is a map which maps the untilded, just x1 to xn coordinates into the x tilde coordinate. So it is the Jacobian of that map which has come up here. See? It's the x tilde by dx. It is the all the derivatives of that map from Rn to Rn. And that map is also often written as capital D phi. Just the Jacobian matrix. Right? So what we have is that if we're given some tangent vector in the tangent space to P, then its images in the charts alpha and theta, namely the image eta over here with coefficient eta I, and the image of the tangent vector over there with coefficient mu I, are related in this way, and we can write it also through this Jacobian matrix. Because the x tildes are really the phi of x. The physicist's definition of tangent vectors uses just that. It says that, well, we'll get to that, but you guess it, right? At every point on the abstract manifold, a tangent vector is described by an n-tuple that is for every chart, by an n-tuple, and when you change chart, it has to transform in this way. But of course, the disadvantage of this distance is that you have to rely on chart. You can only write down a tangent vector if you write down a chart. But in the abstract algebraic definition, we can simply say that the tangent vector is any linear map from function jumps into real numbers that obeys the Lattice rule. No mention of charge in here. Okay, so we arrive here at the physicist definition of the tangent space. A tangent vector psi, according to the physicist definition, is a map that assigns to each germ of a charge a coefficient vector Rn such that the coefficient vector with respect to a charge alpha and is related to the coefficient vector with respect to a charge beta in this way. So far we had two equivalent definitions of tangent, of the tangent space to manifold at a point. algebraically, as we said, any tangent vector is any linear map that obeys the Leibniz rule, any linear map onto a real number. And the idea was that we identify tangent vectors with directional derivatives, and derivatives are identified to the Leibniz. Then the physicist definition was you have n tuples with respect to a charge, and they have to in order to qualify as being tangent vectors, they have to transform in a particular way when you transform the charge. Now, the third definition that is sometimes used for is the geometric definition of the tangent space. Here, the idea is the following: tangent vector should be literally determining tangent. So, if this is our manifold, P is the point in the manifold, and the manifold has some radius, then consider a path in the manifold that happens to pass through the point P. Then, let us differentiate that path at the point P. That should be giving us a tangent of the path at point P. The set of all tangents the paths can have as they go through the point P should be in one-to-one correspondence to the tangent vector space. So the tangent space as a set of tangents to path. Consider path in manifold that pass through a point P. And how do we describe a path? Path is a map gamma from the real numbers into the manifold, or at least some subset of the real number. You can think of this as being like the time. So as the time progresses, you are traveling through the manifold. And let's say that at time equals zero, but really don't get too hung up on the issue of time, right? It's not a matter of time, really, it's just some parameter. At the parameter value zero, the path should be at the point P. We can choose this without restricting generality. Now, for every function on the manifold, and that could be, for example, just to illustrate it, a temperature function. The temperature on the manifold might be a function of where you are on the manifold. You have that the concatenation of gamma with F. So you take the path and then feed the position of the path. You remember what the path does? You feed in a time and you get the position of the manifold out of it. And then you feed that position into the temperature function. So you get a function from the real number from the real number. It's like from the time to the temperature. So your path is traveling in time through the manifold, and as you go through the manifold, the temperature changes because you are going from one place with one temperature to another place with another temperature. Okay, so they obtain a map from real numbers into real numbers. Then we say that two differentiable paths, gamma A and gamma B, are called equivalent if for all functions in the algebra of function germ, we have that the derivative of this function that we just had, you know, the temperature as a function of the time, for example, if we differentiate that with respect to the time, we get the same no matter which path we take. And that ought to be true for all F, for all temperature functions. So intuitively, what that means is that two paths are equivalent if they go through the point P with the same velocity, same direction, same speed. So this has got to be true for all F, for all temperature functions. So the geometric definition of the tangent space is then tangent space is the set of equivalence classes of differentiable paths to P. if we didn't form the equivalence classes, it would again be wasteful, because we would say that one path gives us a tangent vector and another path gives us a tangent vector, but since both paths, since the two paths may be totally different, except that they have the same tangent, the same velocity at the point P, we might want to count them as different vectors, but we shouldn't. Okay? We should consider all those paths as completely equivalent, which have the same velocity through the point P. So this equivalence path of paths that have the same velocity through the point P, that equivalence class denotes one tangent vector. Now let's ask whether the geometrically defined tangent vectors and the algebraically defined tangent vectors are equivalent. See, if we do that, we manage to do that, then we have shown that the three definitions are equivalent, because we went from the algebraic to the physicist definition, and now if we can show that the physicist definition, that the algebraic definition and the geometric definition are equivalent, then all the three are equivalent. So every path gamma, each equivalence class of differentiable path, really, I'm just saying for short path, defines a linear map gamma prime. So if gamma is the path, gamma path, the gamma bar, is defined to be a linear map. Okay, it's a different thing. Gamma is a path, and gamma bar, it's a linear map that I will define in a moment, which takes function germs into real numbers. Just like tangent vectors, according to the algebraic definition, are doing. They take functions and give you a number. They take function germs and give you a number. So what is this gamma bar? I define it to be the map that you feed a function, not really a function germ, and then you map it into the following number. The number that you get by taking the path, feeding it into the function, and differentiating with respect to the time parameter of the path at time t equals 0. Which you can tell me, it's the directional derivative, right? So, that's a linear map that maps functions into real numbers, and because it is a derivative, it's just a one-line proof, it's also obeying, a two-line proof, it's also obeying the Leibniz rule. That's what we have to show now. It says a linear map, still have to show it obeys the Leibniz rule. If it does, then we're in business. And we show that every path, every equivalence class of path, defines for us a tangent vector according to the algebraic definition. So, let's check that. We have gamma bar, this map, applied to the product of two functions is the time derivative of the product of the two functions on the path at t equals 0. But now, since this is just a regular derivative, we know that it obeys the Leibniz rule. So we get this, which we can read off is simply the evaluation of the path, of the path linear map times v plus s times the path linear map of v. So we've confirmed that the Leibniz rule holds for that definition of tangent vector, and that was in one-to-one correspondence to the geometric definition. Okay. Now that we have the tangent vector, that we define tangent vectors in all possible ways, let's define the cotangent vector. The cotangent space will be denoted, the cotangent space at the point P of the manifold will be called TPM star. Remember from linear algebra that when you're given an n-dimensional vector space V, you can look at the linear maps that take vectors of your vector space into real numbers. And it turns out that those linear maps themselves form a vector space. And if you have a linear map that takes vectors into real numbers, then the sum of such two linear maps is also a linear map that does this. And from there you can show that, well, the set of all linear maps that map vectors in a vector space into real numbers itself forms a vector space. And that is called the dual vector space. So the set of linear maps omega that maps V into R forms an n-dimensional vector space. Simply because those linear maps obey the axioms of vector space, you can add them, you can multiply them with the number, and you still get a linear map from V into R. And that's all you need for this vector space, and it's a little calculation to show that it's also n-dimensional. But that's just linear. So this dual vector space is usually called V star. Now, the dual vector space to our tangent space is called the cotangent space. And here's the notation for it, just the star. Now, for every germ of a function at the point P, and we may single out such a germ by choosing some function f, we actually naturally obtain an element of the cotangent space. Let's repeat that. For every function germ, you automatically get an element of the cotangent space, which you may call dS. It's the so-called differential of it. And how do we get that? dF, if it's really an element of the cotangent vector space, it should be a linear map that maps tangent vectors into real numbers. Okay? Because the cotangent space consists of the set of all linear maps that feed on tangent vectors and give you out a number. So the dF, if it's really an element of the cotangent vector space, as I'm claiming, should be feeding on tangent vectors and giving you a real number. And here's the trick how you can do it. You define dF to be that linear map which maps a tangent vector into the application of the tangent vector on F. Remember, tangent vectors feed on a function and give you a real number. So dF maps tangent vectors into real numbers by letting the tangent vector feed up the function germ. So the map D can be viewed as a map. The D itself, the letter D, can be viewed as a map. It maps function germs into cotangent vectors. D is extremely important in differential geometry. It will turn out to be a so-called co-boundary operator. The so-called co-boundary operator, and there's a reason why it's called the co-boundary operator. What do you imagine is a boundary operator? Well, if you take a manifold, like a flying carpet. Now, what would be the boundary operator applied to that? It would give you the boundary of your flying carpet, right? The boundary of it. Or let's say you take one of those children's globes made out of plastic, hollow, made out of plastic, and imagine it breaks, as it usually does, and then it falls apart into two pieces at the equator. So you take this half sphere. Not the half ball, but the half sphere. What you imagine is the boundary operator's action on the half sphere. The equator, the circle, right? So it's clear what the boundary operator does. Take the manifold and maps it into its boundary. Okay? That is the co-boundary operator. And as we will later see a few lectures from now, it is doing the same thing. In fact, it is the boundary operator looked at from a different perspective. It's a rather deep result of differential geometry that this is so. But there's a reason why D is called the co-boundary operator, and that is that actually from a certain perspective, it is exactly doing this through the Stokes theorem. If you're familiar with the Stokes theorem, in the fully general Stokes. Okay, so maybe we leave it. Well, maybe I'm going to mention this one thing. So what concretely is D of F in a coordinate system. So, in a coordinate system, we have that a tangent vector and a function germ correspond to some concrete tangent vector directional derivative in Rn, and the function germ corresponds to some concrete function in Rn, from Rn into R. Then, what does dg do? G is our function, and dg is a cotangent vector, right? Remember that d, the coboundary operator, is supposed to do that. You feed in any function at a point, function germ at a point, and you get out a cotangent vector at this point. So dg is supposed to feed on a tangent vector, any element of the tangent vector space, and give you a real number. How should it do it? Well, the dg should map the tangent vector, that's an element of this space here, and maps it into the action of the tangent vector applied to the function g. Remember that tangent vectors can be applied to function g at the point in question, and they give you a number out of the directional derivative, right? And that is concretely eta I, that's why we put it in a chart, so that we can write out this stuff explicitly. The eta is really given concretely as some linear coefficient times the partial derivative, and the function g is also totally explicit, so we can have this act on that, and we get a real number out of it. That is what the cotangent vector is doing. Mapping tangent vectors into this real number over there. All right. Okay, I think we are out of time for today. Are there any questions in Waterloo or Guelph or in the room?
Tangent vector acts on the function and the function gives you the number.
Yes, we define tangent vectors in this way. A tangent vector at a point is a map that takes a function term at this point and maps it into a real number in such a way that the Lagrangian is uniform. In such a way that if you fit in two functions, then you can disentangle that using the Lagrangian. The tangent vectors, don't think of them as pointing somewhere. Don't think of them as tuples of any numbers. Think of them as linear maps that map function germs into real numbers.
So the moment you will have a tangent vector space, you automatically have a cotangent.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, but it's not limited to different geometry. Whenever you have a vector space, you have also the dual vector space. Dual vector space consisting of all the linear maps from the first vector space into real numbers. Remember that as a general feature of mathematics, and Kant emphasizes enough, a vector space could be really anything, right? I mean, anything that has the property that you can add two of them and you get one of those again, and then you can multiply with a number and you get one of those again, it's vector space. It could be, for example, the space of solutions to a differential equation. If you take, if the differential equation is linear, take one solution, take another solution, add them to the solution. Take one solution, multiply with 7, you get the solution. So the solutions to a linear differential equation form a vector space. Right? And so vector spaces can be a lot of things. Anything that obeys the axiom is a vector space. And that's how you have to understand the dual vector space as well. It consists of the linear map from a first vector space into real numbers. Since the sum of two such linear maps is still a linear map from the first vector space into real number, and since a linear map multiplied with any number like 7 is still a linear map, that's all you need. It's a vector space. So you have to do a vector space. It takes a little bit to show that it has the same dimension as the original space and so on, which is only true in finite dimension. But that's just an algebra.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, any questions in Guelph or Waterloo? No? Well, then, let's meet again on Monday. Any feedback about the connection as well? Did it get any better?